Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Assistant Professor in Small Animal Orthopaedics at Michigan State University, Karen Perry. Thank you, Karen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Good afternoon, everybody. So today we're going to be talking about inflammatory joint conditions in both dogs and cats, how they can be diagnosed and the process of going through and classifying what type of disease we may be dealing with, and also how they can then go on to be treated. And I think while the prognosis with many inflammatory joint conditions is often considered to be very guarded, if we were to be able to diagnose them earlier and start appropriate therapy a bit sooner, I think we may be able to improve on this. And so I guess that's really the aim of this webinar today, is to maybe help us achieve those goals. So inflammatory joint disorders are relatively rare. They may affect just one joint in isolation, or I guess more commonly, we see them in the form of polyarthritis, so affecting multiple different joints. And the main findings of these diseases, and this is going across the spectrum of the inflammatory joint diseases, will be this marked inflammation of the synovial lining and migration of inflammatory cells into the joint fluid. So, when we think about the classification of the inflammatory arthritides, I think it can sometimes seem very, very complex. And also, it can sometimes seem rather like an academic exercise and maybe not really important to try and really truly classify what type of the inflammatory arthritis we're dealing with. But this really is quite important in terms of coming up with an appropriate therapeutic plan and also in giving an accurate prognosis to owners. So I would suggest that whenever circumstances permit, we do need to try and achieve an accurate classification for all cases. The inflammatory arthritides can be either infectious or immune-mediated, and they are then further subdivided into erosive and non-erosive based primarily on radiographic findings. And on this slide, you can see there are a large number of potential causes of infectious arthritis, some of which we may not commonly think about as a cause of arthritis. I think while we commonly think about septic or bacterial arthritis, we would maybe less commonly think about the fungal or viral causes that you can see here, for example. But they do have to remain on our radar. And this is particularly important for some of those infectious causes, which it may be very difficult to achieve a positive culture with, such as the L-form bacteria and the mycoplasma, as unless we already have these on our differential lists and develop a high index of suspicion for them, they can be very easily missed. When we think about the non-infective conditions, these are obviously going to include both primary and reactive immune-mediated polyarthritis. We also have the conditions such as systemic lupus erythematosus and the related conditions there, and also rheumatoid-like arthritis and in cats, periosteal proliferative polyarthritis as well. So when we think about the classification that was seen on the previous slide for non-erosive and erosive forms of non-infectious arthritis, that does seem rather simplistic, and several other categories can be involved. So non-erosive polyarthropathies have been broadly classified into types 1 to 4, but we do also have to include the SLE, the systemic lupus erythematosus, and those related disorders, polyarthritis polymyositis syndrome, polyarthritis polymeningitis syndrome, all of the breed-specific polyarthropathies, and also drug-induced polyarthropathy as well. Tick-borne infectious diseases, especially ehrlichiosis, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and Lyme disease may also be implicated if you're in endemic areas, either as direct pathogens or also by causing a reactive polyarthritis as well. So we do need to keep all of these things in mind when it comes to classification. So going through all of the different types that we can come across then, so idiopathic or type 1 immune-mediated polyarthritis is certainly the most common non-erosive immune-mediated polyarthritis that we encounter. And this category will be applied when an underlying cause cannot be identified. So necessarily, this is a diagnosis of exclusion. Stiffness will be the most common clinical sign that we normally see with these cases, and pyrexia and lymphadenopathy will also be relatively common. The carpal and tarsal joints are the ones that are most commonly affected. We do sometimes see the stifle and elbow joints being affected later on in the disease process as well. While hematologic abnormalities are often noted, with neutrophilic leukocytosis being probably the most common, really the clinical signs, initial laboratory, and clinical investigative findings, while they are frequently abnormal, are generally pretty non-specific. And certainly, we haven't managed to prove that they're associated with any likelihood of recovery or associated with the prognosis for this condition at all. The photos in this case are from an 8-year-old female spayed flat-coated retriever who initially presented to me with a right hind limb lameness, and then on further questioning of the owner, there was a mild left forelimb lameness that had sometimes been associated as well. And we did diagnose this dog with idiopathic type 1 immune-mediated polyarthritis. But as we said, this is a diagnosis of exclusion. So, in order to get this diagnosis, we had to do appendicular radiography, we did synoviocentesis, complete blood count, serum biochemistry, urinalysis, including a protein creatinine ratio, tick titers, an abdominal ultrasound, and thoracic radiographs. And we certainly could have done more tests in this case, but that's where we kind of stopped here. And I think what this brings to mind is when we're trying to diagnose a type 1 immune-mediated polyarthritis, it is really important that we have a really in-depth discussion with the owners before we start doing all of this testing, because this testing can become pretty financially demanding for owners and also can become pretty frustrating because these tests take some time to perform. And really, what we're kind of hoping for is that all of the results come back negative. But certainly, that can be a bit of a frustrating process for owners to go through. So I think it's important to have informed them of the process and what you're expecting and what you're hoping for before you even start. Type 2 immune-mediated polyarthritis will be those that are associated with an infection which is remote from the joint. And type 2 cases have been reported to account for approximately 25% of cases of non-erosive immune-mediated polyarthritis in dogs. We don't really have those numbers for cats, unfortunately. It's thought that the chronic infection in these cases acts as a persistent source of antigens that then drives the chronic immune complex disease. And sites of infection that have been associated with immune-mediated polyarthritis do include endocarditis, respiratory tract infections, genitourinary tract infections, pyoderma, and abscessation as well. So in these cases, a thorough physical exam to look for any of these potential sites of infection is important. In dogs with type 2 immune-mediated polyarthritis, treatment of the initiating infection can sometimes bring about resolution of the immune-mediated polyarthritis as well. However, this is not necessarily the case, and it is possible, even once the infection is resolved, for these dogs to suffer chronic or recurrent immune-mediated polyarthritis. Type 3 immune-mediated polyarthritis is that which is associated with some form of gastrointestinal disease. And in these cases, the gastrointestinal tract is considered to be a potential source of bacteria and food antigens that then trigger the immune complex disease. And IMPA that is associated with some form of gastrointestinal disease has been reported to account for approximately 15% of cases of non-erosive immune-mediated polyarthritis in dogs. So, although it's the least common so far, you can see 15%, that's still more than 1 in 10 that we're going to see. So, it is important to be considering this as a potential. And in these dogs, the most common gastrointestinal signs that we see will be vomiting and diarrhea. Unfortunately, we do also see immune-mediated polyarthritis that is associated with neoplasia, and that those will be the type 4 cases. In these cases, the tumor cells serve as a source of persistent antigens, and that triggers the secondary immune-mediated polyarthritis. Now, in these cases, clinical progression of the polyarthritis does normally parallel that of the cancer itself. So if it is possible to surgically remove the tumor or medically treat that, then that will usually result in a marked regression of the polyarthritis. However, obviously, conversely, if it's not possible to treat the tumor, unfortunately, getting on top of the polyarthritis can also be very difficult. Systemic lupus erythematosus is an immune-mediated disorder which is associated with the appearance of anti-nuclear antibody. And most cats and dogs that present with this condition will present with pyrexia as a predominant clinical sign, and also a symmetric non-erosive immune-mediated polyarthritis, so affecting symmetrically the distal limb joints, not most commonly, normally both carpi, often both tarsi as well. However, they will have a combination of other very stereotypical clinical signs, and this can include anything from various skin diseases, mucocutaneous ulceration, immune complex glomerulonephropathy, hemolytic anemia, leukopenia, lymphopenia, or thrombocytopenia. They can also have aseptic meningitis, polymyositis, serositis, or a range of ophthalmic conditions too, including keratoconjunctivitis, cica, retinopathy, or, as in this case, a quite severe uveitis. And in order to come up with a definitive diagnosis of SLE, we really make that on the appearance of these stereotypical clinical signs in conjunction with a positive anti-nuclear antibody titer. The polyarthritis polymyositis syndrome is a little bit of a frustrating one. We really don't know what the cause for this condition is, but there are several criteria that need to be met in order to achieve a diagnosis. So normally what we're looking for in these cases is, again, a non-erosive symmetrical inflammatory arthropathy, and then also clinical features that are consistent with an inflammatory polymyopathy. This will include bilaterally symmetrical muscle atrophy, myalgia or muscle pain, and they will, in some chronic cases, also develop some muscle contracture too. We do need to confirm that the myositis is present on a muscle biopsy. And also, it's important to exclude other clinically similar conditions that can look very, very similar, such as rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus erythematosus, and also bacterial endocarditis as well. The polyarthritis polymeningitis syndrome is a little bit of an interesting one. So, we do commonly see spinal pain in cases that we have diagnosed with immune-mediated polyarthritis. But it can become a little bit of a debate whether this is due to the polyarthritis affecting the vertebral articular facets or whether we have this concomitant steroid-responsive meningitis arteritis. And although it's an interesting thing, and academically, I'm sure we'd all love to get on top of finding out exactly which condition we're dealing with, this is one of those situations where I think we have to be a little careful about how many tests we want to put an individual patient through. And we'll go on to talk about this a little bit later on when we come on to our diagnostic tests. But certainly, if a test has some risk associated with it and it is not going to change how we're going to treat that patient, then my opinion generally is that if it's not going to change how I'm going to treat the patient, I'm probably not going to go ahead and perform that additional test. Much as academically, I would love to have that definitive diagnosis. It's really not of any benefit to the patient for me to put them through that additional test. So, in this case, in order to definitively say we have a polymeningitis, then we would need to analyse the cerebrospinal fluid. And obviously, although it's not a difficult test for us to do, it does put the patient at some risk. It does require general anaesthesia. And I think we have to think very carefully about whether we really need that information when these patients are going to get treated fairly similarly, whether they have a polyarthritis or the polyarthritis polymeningitis syndrome. There are several breed-associated non-erosive immune-mediated polyarthritis syndromes that have been reported as well. Probably the ones that have been best characterized are the ones associated with Akitas and Sharpeys, but we certainly do see these in Boxers, Weimaraners, Bernese Mountain Dogs, German Shorthaired Pointers, Spaniels, and Beagles as well. So if you are seeing these patients presenting with a pyrexia of unknown origin or a shifting lameness, then you may want to be having these polyarthropathies further up on your list than you may have previously. Drug-induced immune-mediated polyarthritis is seen relatively rarely, but certainly can be a side effect of some antibiotic treatment, especially when we're using the sulfonamides. But it can also be associated with penicillin derivatives, erythromycin, lincomycin, and the cephalosporins as well. And in these cases, it is hypothesized that the immune complex hypersensitivity reactions occur as a result of drug-antibody interactions. In the cases where there has been reported, the time from drug initiation to the onset of lameness generally ranges from somewhere between 7 to 21 days. And if we do go ahead and perform synovial fluid analysis in these affected cases, we do see the very stereotypical changes that we would expect with immune-mediated polyarthritis of other causes. So we do see this predominance of neutrophils, generally without any toxic change and certainly without any visible organisms within the cells. And typically in these cases, if we do withdraw the offending drug, this will lead to an improvement in lameness very, very quickly within 1 to 3 days. So really, this just has a very positive prognosis as long as we recognize that it's us that's actually caused this condition to occur and withdraw the drug appropriately. So when we come on to then to the classification of erosive immune-mediated polyarthritis, erosive arthropathies will include the canine rheumatoid arthritis, idiopathic erosive arthritis, feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis, and also a breed-specific polyarthritis, which is recognized in greyhounds. And the term idiopathic erosive arthritis has recently come into favour because there are several differences between what has been called canine rheumatoid arthritis and the human disease of the same name. And one of those notable differences is if we think about rheumatoid factor, which is necessary in order to diagnose a human with rheumatoid arthritis, rheumatoid factor has been detected in less than 30% of dogs with rheumatoid arthritis in some of the studies. So in cases where rheumatoid factor is not detected, it may be more appropriate to term this an idiopathic erosive arthritis. And this is also true in cats as well that suffer from the same condition. It is a little bit of an academic thing. What we call the disease really doesn't affect how we treat it. These will be treated similarly. I really bring this up. If you're reading about this condition in some more of the recent literature, you may come across this term idiopathic erosive arthritis, rather than the term rheumatoid arthritis. In cats, we used to talk about there being two forms of feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis. We used to say there is an erosive form and also a proliferative form as well. However, we now consider it more likely that that erosive form is truly a kind of rheumatoid-like arthritis or an idiopathic erosive arthritis in cats, similar to the condition in dogs, and that feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis truly only has that one proliferative form. When we talk about rheumatoid arthritis or idiopathic erosive arthritis, this will be characterized by a deforming symmetric polyarthritis generally. And the term that really stands out there is deforming, and this is how we really differentiate this from the typical non-erosive arthritis. Non-erosive arthritis, we would not expect to see deformation of the joints. However, with the erosive arthritis, we certainly do, particularly with chronicity. And this does have a real impact on their prognosis long term, because even if we can get the condition under control with medication, those deformations and the joint laxity that we see does not respond to that. And they may go on to need further treatment, as we'll go on to discuss. The erosive arthritides are generally associated with synovitis of the joints and also often the tendon sheaths as well. We do see articular cartilage loss, we do see erosion of the juxta-articular bone, and in some patients we do detect this presence of this IgM rheumatoid factor. The destruction of the articular cartilage and the subchondral bone is often associated with an invasive tissue in joints, which is called pannus. And if you've seen this in joints, it really does look like granulation tissue covering the surface of the joint. So it's a very characteristic appearance if you see it. Canine and feline rheumatoid arthritis are distinguished from other immune-mediated polyarthritis syndromes by virtue of radiographically diagnosed erosive changes in the joints and the appearance of rheumatoid factor in the serum in some cases. And whilst a positive rheumatoid factor test is certainly not necessary, nor is it sufficient to come up with a definitive diagnosis, there are modifications of the Rose-Waller test or the ELISA tests, which are used in dogs, which have also been used to measure rheumatoid factor in cats. So if this is something you want to do, you can measure rheumatoid factor in both dogs and cats, associated with your diagnosis. The breed-specific polyarthritis that has been noted in greyhounds has been reported to generally affect dogs that are pretty young. So it's actually a very sad condition when we encounter it. It normally affects dogs between 3 and 30 months of age. The condition is characterized by it can be very mild or it can be to very severe fluctuating swelling of the limb joints, and generally affects the joints distal to and including the elbows and stifles. And this condition leads to the accumulation of excessive joint fluid, very thickened synovial membranes, and ulcerative erosions of the articular cartilage as well. And say in many dogs, the tendon sheaths in the carpal and tarsal regions are also affected by this and become really quite effusive. And in these cases, rheumatoid factor and anti-nuclear antibodies are also both negative, and generally on blood work, there are no significant abnormalities at all. So feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis generally occurs most commonly in young adult males, but it can occur at any age. The carpus and the hock are most frequently affected, and we do sometimes see concurrent edema of the skin and the soft tissues overlying the joints as well. I think something that's important to remember for all of the erosive conditions and this feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis as well is that the radiographic changes that are very stereotypical do very much lag behind clinical signs. And in this feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis, radiographic signs may not be present for the first 10 to 12 weeks. So that really can make it a little difficult to make a prompt diagnosis in these cases. The earliest radiographic signs that we see in these cases do include periarticular soft tissue swelling, and we may see some mild periosteal proliferation as well, but that can be quite difficult to discern from just some degenerative changes in the joint. So certainly this does complicate things somewhat. These changes do progress over time and become very dramatic, such that they really can't be mixed up with anything else. As you can see on this image here, they can lead to total joint ankylosis. We do also see periarticular osteophytes and enthesiophytes in some cases, and in some of these cases, we can see subchondral bone cyst-like lesions and erosions, as well as this kind of progressive ankylosis as well. Something that's important to think about with these inflammatory arthropathies is the big difference between dogs and cats. So, in dogs, immune-mediated disease is far more common than infectious disease. Immune-mediated polyarthritis can occur as a primary disorder, as we've discussed, usually of idiopathic origin, or it can be secondary to systemic infectious, neoplastic, or parasitic disease. And in dogs, the inflammatory arthropathies will be much more commonly polyarticular than monoarticular, and much more commonly non-erosive than erosive. If we contrast that to cats, however, cats, as we've heard many times, they are not small dogs. They do differ, and in these conditions, they certainly do. In cats, infectious causes of inflammatory arthritis are much more common than the primary immune-mediated conditions. And there are many different infectious causes, as we saw on that earlier slide, so different bacterial and mycoplasmal species, viral, fungal, and tick-borne rickettsial, which are less commonly encountered in dogs. Infectious agents generally do cause arthritis by direct infection of the synovium, but we can also see reactive polyarthritis, which is secondary to systemic infection. So we see these circulating immune complexes being deposited in joints, resulting in a sterile synovitis. And when we do see these infectious conditions, you can see here on this slide, this is kind of the stereotypical cytology that you might want to look at, is that we can see in these pictures that we have some intracellular bacteria, particularly in this cell here. I think you can see that. And then we also have some extracellular bacteria on the slide as well, which I think you can see delineated by this arrow. So moving on then to our history and physical examination for these cases. And at this point, I'd like you to meet Rosie. Rosie was a pretty complex case, and I'm going to use her as an example of case workup. So we're going to keep coming back to her through the remainder of this presentation. Rosie was a 5-year-old female neutered Griffon-Bruxellois who initially presented to our neurology service. She had slowed down a lot, and the owner reported that she appeared to be moderately uncomfortable, but she didn't really have any other specific signs. There was a suspicion of syringomyelia from the referring veterinarian, which is completely understandable given the breed, and they had noticed some spinal pain on their examination as well. Our neurology service did find the mild spinal pain. They concurred with that. that, and they did go ahead and perform an MRI, but they did not find any convincing evidence of disease. And at this point, she was sent home with just some symptomatic pain relief and just advice for monitoring to see how she went. A few months later, she then presented to orthopedics with the signs that you can see here. So she now had severe joint laxity affecting the carpi, which was making it pretty difficult for her to walk. The owners had noticed that the carpi seemed to swell intermittently. And the signs were reported to have progressed very, very rapidly over the last 2 weeks. So for a few weeks, she'd been absolutely fine following her appointment with neurology. It had remained very static. And then suddenly, over 2 weeks, this joint laxity had become apparent. So I guess when we think about that, is this a typical history for a case of inflammatory arthritis then? And I think the onset of clinical signs associated with inflammatory arthritis can be either very acute or very chronic. And the clinical severity can be highly variable, with presentations ranging from anything from a complete inability to stand with multiple and obvious joint effusions at one end of the spectrum to low-grade insidious onset stiffness or even just a single limb lameness at the other end. And inflammatory arthritis really has to be considered as a differential for any dog or cat who presents with signs of multiple joints pain or swelling, presents with generalized stiffness, a shifting lameness, or just pyrexia of unknown origin. And actually, recent studies have indicated that pyrexia of unknown origin may actually turn out to be immune-mediated polyarthritis in really quite a high percentage of cases. Up to 1 in 5 of these cases may be immune-mediated polyarthritis. So we really need to have this on our differential list for a lot of these cases. Acute onset signs do tend to be more common with these conditions. An inflammatory monoarthritis will often result in an obvious lateralized lameness. However, in cases of polyarthritis, this may not be as obvious, and owners may report anything from a complete reluctance to move to a shifting limb lameness to just a stiff and stilted gait. Some owners do report that their pets have suddenly resented being handled and when they've previously loved to be petted. And these conditions can also, as we mentioned earlier, affect the articulations of the vertebral column. So animals may present with something just as simple as an altered head carriage or sometimes a reluctance to eat and drink due to their bowl being on the floor. Pets with inflammatory arthritis also are often systemically ill, so they may present with very vague history, including lethargy, inappetence, or, as we said, simply pyrexia. So I think what this shows is there really is no typical history for a case of inflammatory arthritis. It can be incredibly variable, and therefore we really just have to keep it on our differential list wherever appropriate. And in fact, it has been said in multiple texts that frequently the main reason for missed diagnoses of inflammatory arthritis is a failure to have the condition on the differential list in the first place. So pets with a history that is suspicious of polyarthritis should undergo comprehensive general and orthopedic examinations. But we do need to be aware that in these patients, the pain can be pretty severe and pretty generalized. So we really need to handle these patients very gently, and some patients can be difficult to fully examine. And certainly something that I find with these patients is that this can be very emotive for owners to watch. It's not that they have one painful joint, they have pain on pretty much everything we do. And so I do often offer to owners that I can examine the dog or pet or cat away from them if they would find that easier, because it is really hard for them to watch their pet reacting painfully to every single test that we're doing throughout the whole examination. With inflammatory arthritis, joint pain and joint effusion generally will be readily appreciable on palpation. Pronounced swelling and edema of the overlying soft tissues may also be present. And in some cases, we have seen draining tracts and subcutaneous abscesses reported in the infectious cases, particularly those that are caused by mycobacteria or L-form bacteria. If you do see rheumatoid-like arthritis, then this certainly can cause palpable joint instability, subluxation, or deformity secondary to joint contracture. And feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis, conversely, can cause a restriction in joint range of motion. And as you can see here, this poodle who presented to us, this toy poodle, has certainly quite pronounced joint laxity, not quite as severe as Rosie's yet, but this was another case of that rheumatoid-like arthritis with joint laxity affecting multiple joints. Bilaterally symmetrical joint involvement certainly is common. However, some cases are asymmetric and immune-mediated polyarthritis can present as only affecting a single joint. And certainly that has confused me on occasion where I've gone looking for things like cruciate disease or, carpal instability, and it's just been a polyarthritis that's really just a monoarthritis. So we do need to bear that in mind as well. As we said before, pets with inflammatory arthritis can be pyrexic. Lymphadenopathy is commonly found. And also, if we see pets with chronic inflammatory arthritis, especially when they're suffering from the erosive forms, they can suffer this generalized muscle atrophy and weight loss, which leads to a profound cachectic appearance in these patients. And this is a cat which I saw, which had had chronic feline periosteal proliferative polyarthritis, which had not been treated. It was thought the cat just had degenerative joint disease based on early radiographs. And you can see here, I mean, these pictures really don't do justice how cachectic this cat really was. But I think probably the best image is this one looking from above, looking down on the cat. You see how big this cat's head looks relative to the rest of its body. And this cat was really suffering, and looked in really bad shape. So this is a different cat who presented with an erosive polyarthritis in this video. And I think what we can see here, hang on, if I can get this video to play. So I think what we can see here is that when you see a cat or in a dog with erosive polyarthritis, really there aren't going to be very many things that are going to make an animal have this kind of gait assessment. So I think really the surprising thing with this cat is how apparently comfortable it seems to be with its profound debilitation secondary to its disease. It's still coming in for head rubs. It still kind of seems to be loving life, even though it has zero stability in either carpus, as you can see. So in this situation, this cat had no history of trauma. There was nothing in its history to suggest that we could have had medial collateral ligament ruptures or bilateral carpal hyperextension. It was a house cat, and the owner was around most of the time. So when you see a cat walking like this, really erosive polyarthritis is going to be very high on your list very quickly. However, it certainly isn't always this obvious. So going back to Rosie then, the physical examination findings for Rosie were that she did have palpable effusion in both carpi, both tarsi, both stifles, and both elbows. She had pain on manipulation of both carpi and both tarsi, profound laxity affecting both carpi, and moderate laxity affecting both elbows and both stifles as well. She did have mild laxity affecting both tarsi and also both shoulders too, and she still had that neck pain which had been reported right from her earliest examination. So moving on then to our diagnostic tests for these conditions. And the main obstacle to the diagnosis of immune-mediated polyarthritis, as we mentioned earlier, is a failure to include the disease as a differential. The diagnostic tests themselves are really not that difficult to perform at all. So cytological examination of synovial fluid is probably the single most important tool in the diagnosis of inflammatory arthritis. And even when only one joint appears to be affected on physical exam, it is often recommended in textbooks that at least five joints should be sampled. And this is because it's not uncommon for one joint to be more obviously inflamed and painful than others in cases of polyarthritis, and because it is very possible for us to achieve a diagnosis from both the clinically affected and the non-clinically affected joints. Now, as I say, in textbooks, it always says kind of five joints, sometimes six, and some other textbooks say more like three or four. And I think it can become confusing in how many joints do we really have to sample in these patients. And in my experience, what I tend to do is I tend to keep sampling joints until I think I have at least three and preferably four clean samples. So if I immediately on my first three sticks get three really nice samples, large volume, no blood contamination, that's probably going to be sufficient for me. If my second or third sample has some mild blood contamination, I'm going to carry on and try and get another clean sample there, because we do know that when we have blood contamination, it certainly becomes more difficult to call the results of our cytology. So I try and get at least three really nice clean sticks. And once I've got that, then I'm happy that probably I'm going to be able to get my diagnosis, and I don't necessarily need to keep going on and get five or six joints. As we said, in dogs, bacterial infective arthritis is not super common, but when it does occur, it more commonly affects the larger joints, such as the stifle and the elbow. However, this trend is not necessarily followed in cats, as the most common source of infective arthritis in cats is following cat bite inoculation, and that will primarily affect the most distal limb joints. Immune-mediated disease tends to affect the small distal joints, so carpus and tarsus being most common. And it is important to consider this when we think, well, which joints are we going to go ahead and sample? So it may be that we're most confident sampling the stifle joint because that's the one we've sampled the most and it's a large joint and we can get large volumes. But if you're suspicious of an immune-mediated polyarthritis because it preferentially affects those most distal limb joints, you may want to go after those ones for your first samples, and they may be more likely to give you your definitive answer. So, cytological examination of synovial fluid is, as I said, critically important, not only in establishing a diagnosis of an inflammatory arthropathy, but also in determining causality and therefore the optimal therapy for this patient. So the type and number of leukocytes within the fluid can be used to differentiate between different disease conditions. And synovial fluid can be obtained from all the major joints of the limbs, even the metacarpophalangeal and interphalangeal joints in larger dogs. But generally, if we're talking about cats, only a very small amount of fluid is present in a normal feline joint. So we really only get one drop to about 0.25 mils from the normal shoulder, stifle, and hip joints. And when we get down to the carpal and tarsal joints, really we're talking about like 0.1 of a mil in a normal joint. So really just the hub full of the needle often. However, if they do have joint effusions, this will normally allow retrieval of sufficient synovial fluid for analysis. Now, I'm sure everyone's pretty familiar with how to perform arthrocentesis, so I'm not going to go into this in detail, but I think there are a few points it's important to remember, and certainly these do need to be performed using aseptic technique. And I always recommend that a heavy sedation or a short anaesthetic is really necessary in order to perform the procedure. I normally go with heavy sedation for these patients as long as they're stable enough for that. But for anyone who's had a joint tap performed, when the needle goes through the synovium, it really is a quite painful thing. So even if the patient is seeming very compliant and seems like it's tolerating everything, when that needle pops through, it's likely they really will react quite strongly if they're not adequately sedated. And not only is that going to prevent you from getting a good sample, it's also going to potentially have you causing more trauma to the joint and really not having a very satisfactory experience. So I definitely go with heavy sedation for all of these samples. It is important, I think, in these situations really not to be greedy. So when we first put that needle in, really just want to apply very gentle negative pressure. And what I normally do, if I get a nice clean sample, just a few drops, I will often use those first few drops to make my slides. So I know that my slides for cytology are clean. And then I'll reattach my syringe and apply greater pressure to achieve the greater volumes for sending off for fluid analysis. But as soon as you apply that greater pressure, you do run that greater risk of blood contamination of the fluid, which can complicate your cytology analysis. So I certainly recommend using those first few drops where they're clean to make your slides. Your slides do need to be prepared immediately, and then any remainder can be placed in an EDTA tube. And generally, a sample for bacterial culture should also be taken, and normally recommend this is cultured for aerobic and anaerobic growth, and also if you can consider it appropriate for mycoplasma growth as well. So obviously, normal synovial fluid will generally be clear, colourless, and viscous, and should form a string of about 2 to 4 centimetres between your fingers. If you do see diffuse hemorrhagic or xanthochromics, that would be yellow discoloration, this will suggest prior intraarticular hemorrhage. Increased turbidity is going to suggest that you have an increased red or white cell count, and reduced viscosity is suggesting that you have inflammation present within the joint. Now, cell counts can often be performed in dogs, but they're rarely performed in cats, as generally the samples that we get are just too small for cats. But where possible, your white blood cell count should generally be below 3,000 cells per microliter. And you should be seeing on your slides that about 90% of the cells are mononuclear. So that would be considered normal. Cats do have slightly lower white blood cell counts compared to dogs, but the cell distribution is pretty similar. It is important to note that it's not always possible to differentiate between immune-mediated and infectious causes of arthritis based purely on your cytological findings. Whilst if you see degenerative neutrophils and intracellular bacteria, then you're going to be fairly confident this is an infectious case, the absence of these does not rule out the presence of infection. So your results always need to be interpreted in conjunction with your clinical and radiographic features and also your bacteriological culture results as well. So in relation to that, when we do our differential cell counts, it is important to look at the morphology of the neutrophils that you see. So neutrophils in the synovial fluid from immune-mediated cases will generally exhibit fairly normal morphology. And normal neutrophil morphology will also be expected in cases of rickettsial polyarthritis. But you will sometimes see in those cases intracytoplasmic morulae, and they will occasionally be seen in cases that are suffering either from anaplasmosis or ehrlichiosis. So if you're lucky, you may see one of those. In most cases of septic arthritis, neutrophils will appear toxic or degenerate, and so you may see these intracellular bacteria as well. However, that's not true for all of the causes of septic arthritis. Some of the organisms that we discussed earlier, such as mycoplasma and the group G streptococci, for example, do not tend to induce these abnormalities. So in those cases, the neutrophils will still look morphologically normal. So, and that's one of the reasons why we recommend that all joint fluid should really be cultured, because the neutrophil morphology does not give you the full picture here. Bacteriological evaluation of synovial fluid should include aerobic and anaerobic culture, and if you are concerned about mycoplasma, then swabs need to be submitted for the specific mycoplasmal species. We do recommend sensitivity testing should also be included as well. Some infectious agents are definitely more difficult to culture than others, and even if you have a relatively culturable bacteria, synovial fluid culture will only be positive in about 50% of cases of infectious arthritis. So even if you have 100 obviously infected joints, only 50% of them will culture positive. The rate of positive culture can be improved quite dramatically through the use of broth enrichment media, so thioglycolate blood culture bottles, and incubation of your sample for 24 hours prior to culture. And if we do that, we can take that 50% of positive cultures up to more like 85% or even in some cases 100%. So I definitely recommend doing that. And some labs do that routinely, but you might want to check with your lab whether they do that or not. And if they don't, maybe consider putting your sample in broth enrichment media and sending it to the lab like that. In cases where a positive culture is still not obtained, but you're still suspicious of an infectious cause, then you can use things like blood or urine samples and synovial membrane cultures in order to improve your chances of recovering the clinically relevant pathogen. Synovial biopsy and histopathological examination are probably considered to be indicated if you cannot obtain synovial fluid, or if your cytological examination of synovial fluid is not diagnosed, or if you suspect there may be a tumour in the joint associated. Synovial biopsy, unfortunately, is rarely pathognomonic of a disease, however, as the synovial membrane does tend to react pretty similarly to many different types of injury. If you do need a synovial biopsy, this can be performed either via arthroscopy or by arthrotomy. In most cats, this is done via an arthrotomy and an excisional biopsy, because most of the arthroscopic biopsy needles that we have available are really a little too large comfortably for most feline joints. Excisional biopsy does also have the advantage that you can evaluate the entire joint while you're there, explore simultaneously, and take a selected piece of membrane that maybe appears to be the most pathologic. You do need to take care when you're incising the joint capsule and make sure that you incise longitudinally so that you limit any iatrogenic damage to the surrounding ligaments. And generally, we do recommend taking a full thickness incision and then closing that capsule routinely with sutures. So when we went ahead and did arthrocentesis on Rosie, we did take samples from both carpi, both tarsi, both elbows, and both stifles. And in this situation, we saw similar findings in all of them. So she did have increased volume and turbidity in all of those joints, and cytology indicated a very high nucleated cell count, and almost all of the cells that we saw were neutrophils, but we did not see any toxic change associated with those neutrophils. And culture, although that took us a few days to get back, obviously culture for all of her joints was negative. So as we have now done in Rose, we've kind of confirmed that we have an inflammatory arthritis. We do then need to take steps to classify the type of polyarthritis that we may be dealing with. And as I say, sometimes, although this does seem like an academic exercise, it is important. It does allow us to provide a definitive diagnosis and the appropriate associated prognosis for the owner. It does allow us to prepare the appropriate therapeutic plan for that patient. And it does really, this process is targeted at trying to find any underlying cause that may be evident. And so this is really going to involve a thorough review of physical abnormalities and a thorough review of the history as well. So on physical exam, do you see any of the criteria for systemic lupus erythematosus? Is there a medication history that's consistent with a drug-induced immune-mediated polyarthritis? Are there any signs of GI disease? Are there any signs of infection elsewhere? Is there any evidence of neoplasia? Is there any evidence of spinal pain? Or is there any evidence of muscle atrophy associated? And all of these things are going to start pushing you in maybe a different direction. Additional diagnostic tests may certainly be required in some cases, and it is recommended that all cats with inflammatory joint disease should be tested for feline immunodeficiency virus and feline leukemia virus, since immunosuppression may be a predisposing cause for infectious arthritis, and FELV has been implicated in the development of periosteal proliferative polyarthritis as well. There are some early studies saying that feline syncytium-forming virus has also been implicated in the development of immune-mediated polyarthritis in cats, but the exact role of this virus is not yet clear, and personally, I do not test for this in all cases. Immunologic and serologic testing for Borrelia, rickettsiae, and other infectious agents may be warranted if you're in the endemic regions. And because immunosuppression is the goal of therapy for idiopathic immune-mediated polyarthritis, previous evaluation for infectious or neoplastic disorders certainly is very important. And when reactive polyarthritis is suspected, then we do need a full screen to investigate chronic underlying infection or neoplasia. So this may include complete blood counts, biochemical profiles and blood cultures, urinalysis and urine culture, thoracic and abdominal imaging, bone marrow biopsies, aspirates of enlarged lymph nodes, and also potentially echocardiography. Endocarditis is one possible initiating factor for immune-mediated polyarthritis, and therefore, at the very least, a very careful auscultation of the heart is essential. But echocardiography is often recommended as it does have increased sensitivity for detecting valvular lesions. And obviously, if we have a case with endocarditis and we then start this patient on immunosuppressive therapy, that's going to have a pretty poor outcome pretty quickly. So our additional testing for Rosie, we didn't actually find any underlying cause in her. We did do a thoracic and abdominal CT. That was all clear. We did perform hematology, biochemistry, and urinalysis, and that was all within normal limits. And we did go ahead and do an echocardiography on her, and that revealed no abnormalities. But something that's important to mention with Rosie is that Rosie was fully insured. So really, finances were not a concern for this owner. And in many cases, we're having to balance financial restrictions along with exactly what tests we need to do. So while here we've done everything, in some cases we may need to be a bit more selective about what we can do and just let owners know that maybe we haven't ruled out every possible underlying cause. So when we come to thinking about radiography, radiographs of affected joints do certainly help in differentiating between the erosive and non-erosive inflammatory arthropathies, and they are an important part of our evaluation. But as we mentioned earlier, it is important to realize that the bony changes seen on radiographs in erosive cases do take time to develop, and the clinical signs frequently pre-exist radiographic ones. Therefore, radiographs taken early in the disease process may reveal very little change, except soft tissue swelling, even in cases of erosive polyarthritis. And this is seen here in this case. This case, on this stifle radiograph, all we can see is some soft tissue swelling, evidence of synovial effusion within the joint. But you'd be hard pushed to say whether this was a cruciate or whether this was an erosive polyarthritis at this stage. And this did actually turn out to be an erosive polyarthritis, but this was just a very early stage of it. So, in cases where you suspect erosive polyarthritis, repeating radiographs later in the disease process may be warranted. If you are dealing with a non-erosive inflammatory arthritis, the only reliable radiographic scene that you're going to see throughout the disease process is soft tissue swelling. Now, depending on the age of the patient, radiographic signs of degenerative joint disease may well be present as well, and we do need to be careful to differentiate these from the destructive, punched-out subchondral and periarticular lesions that are associated with erosive inflammatory conditions. So, with chronicity, erosive polyarthritis is going to be characterized by this severe osteoarthrosis, subchondral sclerosis, bone loss, subluxation or luxation of joints, and in some cases, periarticular bone proliferation and mineralization of periarticular soft tissues, such as the tendons and ligaments as well. And I think you'd appreciate in this radiograph here a lot of erosive changes along multiple joint surfaces. So you can see them on the radial carpal bone there, for sure. You can see them in the smaller carpal bones. You can see them at the metacarpophalangeal joints and in the proximal and distal interphalangeal joints as well. So certainly multiple erosive changes there. And with this radiograph, no one is going to miss these radiographic findings. But again, it's not always this obvious, certainly not in the early stages. So when we look at a selection of the radiographs that were taken for Rosie here, you can see that severe erosive changes were found here, and they were found for her in both carpi, both tarsi, both elbows, and both stifles as well. So just showing a selection of views here, but we did take comprehensive views of all joints for her. When we go on to think about serology, this is something that gets debated a lot, and certainly the appearance of rheumatoid factor or antinuclear antibody in serum is not specific for canine rheumatoid arthritis or systemic lupus erythematosus. Both of these can be a feature of other chronic inflammatory conditions. And as such, assays for rheumatoid factor are really only useful in helping to definitively categorize a case of inflammatory arthritis. These tests certainly should not be used as complete diagnostic tests for canine systemic lupus erythematosus or canine rheumatoid arthritis. Also, as we mentioned earlier, rheumatoid factor is only present on serological testing in about 20, well, somewhere between 25 and 75% of dogs with erosive rheumatoid arthritis, depending on which article you read. So what we can take away from that is that definitely the absence of rheumatoid factor does not rule out a diagnosis of erosive polyarthritis. I have to say, for me, this is a test that I have moved away from performing a lot of the time, unless there are absolutely no financial restrictions, and then out of interest, we can certainly run it. But it doesn't really change for me how I go ahead and treat these patients. If I have erosive changes on radiographs, I have an erosive polyarthritis. Rheumatoid factor, presence or absence thereof, is not going to change anything. Certainly, some cases of inflammatory arthritis are complicated by extra-articular disease, and there may be an indication for even more additional investigations. If you have a myositis case, you may consider things like electromyography and muscle biopsy. If you have a suspicion for aseptic meningitis, you may consider cerebrospinal fluid analysis. However, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's really important that as clinicians we carefully consider the risk and associated benefits of all of our additional tests, particularly if they do carry some risk for the patient. And as I said, for me, if the outcome of the test is not going to change my management of the case, then for me the value of the test becomes debatable, and it's something that I really don't push the owners to go ahead and perform. So for Rosie, we did do rheumatoid factor and ANA. I said she was fully insured, so why not? Rheumatoid factor was positive in her case, and ANA was negative. We did consider CSF analysis because of that spinal pain that had been noted initially and was still present, but we elected not to go ahead and do that. We decided it was not going to change our plan for her, and that it would be associated with some risk and therefore wasn't really warranted. So moving on then to treatment of these really quite complex conditions. Treatment of the inflammatory arthritis does require treatment of both the underlying immunologic trigger, if you've identified one, and treatment of the joint inflammation as well. And failure to achieve this goal may result in persistence or recurrence of the clinical signs of inflammatory arthritis. Inflammatory arthritis that is associated with significant concurrent systemic disease does warrant treatment of the primary disorder first and then the synovitis second. So antimicrobial, antiparasitic, antineoplastic, and nutritional therapies will be prioritized. And certainly we can go ahead and treat with analgesics and anti-inflammatory therapies to accompany that, so that we're controlling the level of discomfort associated with the arthritis, but we do get on top of that systemic disease first. And while this is the ideal scenario, it should be recognized that in many instances, no underlying cause is identified. And while this does not necessarily mean an underlying cause does not exist, in those cases, immunosuppression will normally be the management option of choice in these instances. And I think if you talk to people who have treated enough of these cases, you'll find that most people have treated a case considering that it is an idiopathic type 1 immune-mediated polyarthritis and have found later on in the treatment that they were wrong. And I certainly did treat one flat coat retriever as a presumed immune-mediated polyarthritis. We had radiographs of everything. And it did turn out later down the line that this dog did have an osteosarcoma of the L7 vertebra, which on radiographs prior to treatment looked entirely normal, and the tumor developed during our treatment of the polyarthritis. And it was presumed that, at a cellular level, that tumor had been causing the polyarthritis initially and was a reason why we never really got on top of this patient's disease. So I think we always have to warn owners, we haven't found anything. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's nothing there. As a general rule, while non-infectious inflammatory joint disorders are common in dogs, they are rare in cats, as we mentioned, and therefore both infectious and neoplastic causes do need to be definitively ruled out before considering treatment for an immune-mediated disorder in cats. Where any doubt exists, empirical treatment with doxycycline for 2 to 3 weeks is recommended, with the clinical response to this being assessed before pursuing any immunosuppressive therapy in cats. Doxycycline does have antimicrobial properties against some of the infectious causes of polyarthritis, and it also has some immune modulating effects which can improve clinical signs in cats with immune-mediated polyarthritis. So it's a good initial choice if you're not quite sure you've managed to rule out all of the possible infectious causes. Septic bacterial arthritis should be confirmed by identification of intracellular bacteria on cytology or through positive culture of synovial fluid, blood, or urine in a pet that has appropriate clinical signs. And in these cases, antibiotics should be administered as soon as possible after all of the samples have been collected. Prior to receiving your culture and sensitivity results, a broad spectrum antibiotic should be used. I often use amoxicillin clavulanic acid or cephalosporin. This can be altered if required once the sensitivity results have been received. And antibiotics do need to be continued for a total of about 6 weeks. Analgesia normally does need to be attended to for the first 5 to 7 days. And I do also advise cage rest so that we reduce ongoing damage to the articular cartilage. In most cases, if your antibiotic is effective, you should see a dramatic reduction in clinical signs within about 2 to 3 days. And if this is not the case, then a repeat examination certainly would be recommended, with repeat synoviocentesis being performed. And if your total cell counts and differential counts are not improving, then you may want to consider an arthroscopy or arthrotomy to flush the joint and debride the infected tissue to help with your response. Mycoplasma arthritis can be very, very difficult to confirm. Mycoplasma are recalcitrant to culture. If you do have subcutaneous abscesses preceding the polyarthritis in these cases, that may prompt a very high index of suspicion. However, this can also be true of the L-form bacteria as well. And whilst mycoplasmal polyarthritis is classically described as being non-erosive, there are also some reports in the literature about cases with associated erosive changes. And therefore, mycoplasmal polyarthritis cannot be excluded based on just purely radiographic changes. Mycoplasma are usually sensitive to tetracycline or doxycycline. However, there is some evidence that the quinolone antibiotics may be more effective at actually eliminating the organism. So you can use any of these. As for bacterial septic arthritis, in these cases, we do recommend a 6-week course of appropriate antibiotics, although we do normally see a clinical response within about 2 to 3 days. And due to the difficulties in confirming mycoplasmal polyarthritis, even in cases where we have a negative culture result, this is one of the reasons why we recommend that treatment with oral doxycycline for at least 3 weeks before considering treatment with immunosuppressive medications. L-form bacterial arthritis is usually associated with cellulitis, often draining tracts and subcutaneous abscesses in addition to the polyarthritis. And these clinical signs obviously lead you to a high index of suspicion, but confirmation of the diagnosis can be very, very challenging due to the difficulty in culturing the L-form bacteria. Radiographically, we normally just see soft tissue swelling and maybe some periosteal proliferation in the later stages, and we can see in the very late stages some subchondral bone damage as well. And this condition, just because of the difficulty in culturing, is often treated without confirmation of diagnosis. And most bacterial L forms are susceptible to tetracycline or doxycycline. Treatment is continued either for 6 weeks or until at least 1 week after all of the draining tracts have healed. Whichever of those is longer is the one that we recommend. In this cytology slide, there's a thick black arrow which is pointing out a morula within the cytoplasm, and then the thinner black arrow is a Doll body for comparison. Rickettsial polyarthritis is a common clinical condition associated with tick-borne rickettsial disease in dogs. It has been reported far less commonly in cats. A small number of cats that were infected with Anaplasma phagocytophilum have been reported to manifest swollen, painful joints and lameness, but polyarthritis was not confirmed in these cases as synoviocentesis was never performed. These cases do normally present with other associated clinical signs, as you'll be aware, so normally fever, lethargy, anorexia, and lymphadenomegaly as well. And if you do have cats presenting with appropriate clinical signs that have lived in a tick endemic area, then pursuit of this diagnosis would involve cytology to assess for inclusion bodies within the neutrophils and serologic or nucleic acid detection methods as well. And screening for co-infection with other tick-borne pathogens may also be warranted. Treatment of cases of confirmed or suspected anaplasmosis does involve supportive care and, again, administration of doxycycline for at least 4 weeks. Lyme disease, as we all know, is caused by the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi and is transmitted by ticks of the Ixodes group, but its sole role in the pathogenesis of polyarthritis in cats, at least, does remain unclear. While it's fairly common in dogs, naturally occurring Lyme disease has not been described in cats, although experimentally we can induce polyarticular lameness, synovitis, meningitis, and evidence of systemic inflammation in these cases. In endemic regions, serologic screening for Lyme borreliosis is still recommended. Suspected cases should be treated with antibiotics, with doxycycline being the drug of choice, as this will also address co-infections with other tick-borne pathogens. And treatment is normally for between 4 to 6 weeks. For cases where we do not identify any underlying cause, corticosteroids will be by far the most widely used treatment for immune-mediated polyarthritis in dogs, with the most common medication used being immunosuppressive doses of prednisolone. And although the initial response rate has been reported to be very high, as much as 80% of these cases do respond to that initial treatment, adverse effects are really very common and can certainly affect how keen owners are to continue. The adverse effects do range from polyuria, polydipsia, and polyphagia to more serious complications such as diabetes mellitus, urinary tract infections, pyoderma, and the breakdown of collagen in tendons and ligaments. And just last week, I operated on a dog with bilateral cruciate disease secondary to steroid treatment, so this does happen. As a result, alternative or combination treatment is often sought, either to avoid the complications associated with treatment with corticosteroids or to treat disease that does not respond. So in refractory cases or cases that are showing marked corticosteroid-related side effects, or for those with erosive disease or multisystem disease that may require more aggressive therapy, in these cases, an immunosuppressive drug, most commonly either cyclosporin, cyclophosphamide, or azathioprine, is often used in combination with the prednisolone. And combination therapy may result in remission in about 1 to 4 weeks, but the drugs are then usually continued for at least an additional 1 to 3 months before a very gradual withdrawal and then reversion to low to moderate doses of prednisolone in order to maintain remission. Obviously, these drugs do have quite nasty side effects. It is important that we monitor these patients carefully, particularly for myelosuppression. Cats are much more susceptible to azathioprine toxicity, so use of azathioprine is not recommended in this species. Cyclophosphamide should never be used for longer than 4 months due to the risks of hemorrhagic cystitis and bladder malignancy. And certainly when we do encounter side effects or the need for ongoing combination treatment, we may have to consider other options. And certainly there are lots out there. We have less evidence about them, but there is some supportive evidence to support the use of leflunomide, clorambucil, mycophenolate mofetil, levamisil, and also methotrexate as well. Systemic lupus erythematosus, luckily, is a pretty rare multisystemic disease. And affected pets do demonstrate other autoimmune conditions in addition to the polyarthritis. Pets with a typical presentation should have a very thorough workup to exclude infectious or secondary causes of polyarthritis, but thereafter treatment is aimed at immunosuppression and it is prednisolone in combination with other cytotoxic drugs as necessary as for the idiopathic immune-mediated polyarthritis. While the prognosis for the resolution of the systemic lupus erythematosus-associated polyarthritis is good, the prognosis for the other systemic manifestations of the disease is certainly more poor, particularly if these cases are demonstrating renal involvement. So, although the polyarthritis can often be cured, or at least put into remission, the rest of the conditions may have a more guarded prognosis. For feline periosteoproliferative polyarthritis, a treatment trial with immunosuppressive doses of prednisolone is generally recommended, and this can be gradually tapered over 2 to 3 months. While prednisolone may ameliorate the clinical signs and slow down the process of joint destruction, only about half of the cats that we see will respond to this. Disease relapse is very common, and many cats do require lifelong therapy, unfortunately. And the addition of cytotoxic drugs may be considered if there is a lack of improvement when using prednisolone in isolation. Early treatment of rheumatoid arthritis is absolutely essential to achieving a good result, as once we see these destructive changes, the joint laxity, the joint deformation, they are irreversible. Immunosuppressive therapy with prednisolone can be tried, but most animals, particularly cats with rheumatoid arthritis, are only minimally responsive to this. And other potent immunosuppressive agents should be considered. And certainly in cats, positive results in over 50% of cats have been reported following a combination therapy with methotrexate and leflunomide. If we do have persistent soft tissue laxity that is impairing quality of life following control of disease with immunosuppressive therapy, then we may need to consider surgical treatment of these distal limb joints. And most commonly, this has involved arthrodesis. This is certainly a pretty controversial form of treatment, but it can be used to improve functionality and to reduce persistent discomfort in these patients. So for Rosie, we did start her on prednisolone, and at about 2 weeks, we did see her back. She did have some mild side effects, but she was coping pretty well. She had some mild polyuria, polydipsia, and some mild polyphagia as well. Arthrocentesis showed a minimal difference in her cell count, however, so we weren't really getting on top of her condition. So at that stage, we did add in cyclosporine. And with that on board as well, she did respond in terms of both her clinical signs and her arthrocentesis results within a further 2 weeks. So that was much more positive. When we think about surgical treatment and its use in polyarthritis, surgical management is really only very occasionally used in dogs and cats with immune-mediated conditions in the joints. And case selection is very, very important. Arthrodesis and excision arthroplasty have both been reported. And if you look in some of the literature, you'll even hear references to total joint replacement. I have to say, in my hands, a total joint replacement for a patient that is on immunosuppressive therapy would be something I would absolutely not consider appropriate, but it is out there in the literature, so apparently some people have had success with it. These are all definitely salvage procedures. These procedures should definitely only be considered if justified by the potential functional benefits. So, for example, surgery may be justified if the disease is clinically localized to the joints to be operated, but not really if there is major involvement of the other major limb joints in the operated limbs, and also certainly not if we cannot get this condition medically under control. Surgery is only appropriate if we can control the condition medically and know that we are at least slowing down progression of disease in the future. And the surgery is really only being used to treat ongoing laxity or pain that is related to this irreversible damage, which is otherwise, which can be anticipated in this joint and others. So if we look at Rosie, say we managed to control her disease medically using that cyclosporine and that prednisolone, but she still had this dramatic laxity of her carpi. She did have that mild laxity of other joints as well, but that did seem to be not progressive. And she was more mobile, and as she was walking around, she was starting to develop skin lesions on her carpi where she was weight bearing abnormally. And we decided that for long term quality of life, we were going to have to consider surgical treatment. So we did go ahead and we dropped her prednisolone dose right down. So she was only on 0.5 milligrams per kilogram every other day. We kept her cyclosporine dose as it was. To maintain her disease remission, and we did go ahead and perform a bilateral pancarpal arthrodesis in one sitting. And certainly this is controversial. Some people would not agree that this was the right thing to do. But you can see the images of her here pre and 12 weeks post her bilateral pancarpal arthrodesis. And certainly she's not normal. Her elbows are still abducted. Her digits are certainly still affected. But she is now able to move around. She's not developing those skin lesions anymore. And certainly in this situation, I personally felt this was the right thing to do. But certainly prepared to admit it certainly was a controversial way to go. I'm just going to finish off talking briefly about monitoring and prognosis for these patients. So in terms of monitoring, this is super important, and the success of drug therapy in achieving remission and the risks of adverse effects should not be based just on clinical findings alone. We do recommend regular synovial fluid analysis in order to monitor the response to therapy in these inflammatory arthritis cases. 2 weeks after the initiation of therapy, we normally repeat our arthrocentesis and synovial fluid cytology, and effective control of the polyarthritis will be reflected by a normalization of synovial cell counts and a predominance of mononuclear cells in addition to that clinical improvement. Corticosteroid doses will then be gradually tapered with continued improvement of clinical signs and normalization of synovial fluid. But repeated arthrocentesis is important for assessing response to therapy and for assessing maintenance of remission. Combination therapy may be necessary, as we discussed, if the initial response to corticosteroids is incomplete or if whenever you taper the steroids, you get a relapse in the patient's condition. So many of the medications used for polyarthritis management can be associated with severe side effects, and we do need to assess the clinicopathological parameters regularly in order to monitor for these. So we are quite regularly performing hematology, serum biochemistry, and urinalysis in these patients as well. When we think about the prognosis, this does definitely depend on the type of inflammatory arthritis and the presence of any underlying cause. So, following septic arthritis, the prognosis is going to depend on the cause of the infection, the immunocompetence of the patient, and the duration of clinical signs. But it is generally favorable following appropriate antibiosis as long as that is given promptly. The prognosis for idiopathic type 1 INPA does appear to vary. Most dogs with type 1 respond to initial immunosuppressive treatment, but approximately one third of dogs will be expected to relapse and to require further treatment or ongoing combination treatment. Unfortunately, once relapse of these conditions does occur, control of the disease the second time around can be substantially more challenging to achieve, and combination therapy may be more likely to be required. The prognosis for reactive polyarthritis definitely depends on the underlying cause. In one study, unfortunately, one third of cats were euthanized due to persistent lameness or disease relapse. And drug-induced polyarthritis is a very good prognosis because as long as the drug administration stops, the prognosis, is very, very good. For erosive polyarthritis, the prognosis is definitely considered guarded in all cases. Management is very, very challenging. Aggressive combination therapy is indicated, and therapy is there really just to aim to slow progression, to postpone joint subluxation, luxation, ankylosis, and collapse. As we mentioned, once these changes occur, they are irreversible. Unfortunately, the therapy itself can result in serious complications and generally does need to be continued at high doses for 3 to 6 months and at maintenance levels for months to years, and in some cases, lifelong. The prognosis for cats with erosive arthritis is considered to be slightly more guarded based on the limited information that we do have. However, as I mentioned in some of the more recent studies, it does indicate that if we use combination therapy and diagnose promptly, we may be able to achieve a more satisfactory response than we previously thought. And I think when we think about Rosie, when we looked at Rosie when she first came in, I really had a very, very guarded prognosis for this owner. I was not convinced we were going to be able to get on top of this condition very well. However, if you look here, this is a video of Rosie, which I can't actually see how to turn this. Oh, here we go. This is a video of Rosie, which is her 3 years after her bilateral pancarpal arthrodesis. And she's out on her walk with her family. And you can see she's a bit slower than the others. She lags behind a little bit. But she's still going out, she's still enjoying herself, she's still having a great time, the tail's wagging. So really, she was very, very functional. So despite our fairly controversial management of her case, which did raise some eyebrows, you can see that it is possible for these cases to go on to do very well. As I said, we do need to consider earlier, this case had no financial restrictions, which certainly makes things easier. But definitely, it just goes to show that even with the most complicated cases, if owners are able and happy to persist with treatment, it is possible to achieve those good results. So don't give up. We can achieve good results, not in all cases, but in some. And with that, I can move on to take any questions that people may have.
Thanks for that, Karen. There aren't any questions at the moment, but if anyone does have any questions, they can send them in. On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Karen for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.